The following radio play has been adapted from Ramasur, a novel by Rick DeMille. Welcome to the third episode, The Chabuqua Witch.
He's been here since dawn, lying on the wet grass and looking up at the leaden sky, as dark and formless as an untold story. He's alone, listening to cars in the distance and to the great bell at Our Lady of Mercy, calling out the Angelus. In his mind, the man begins to recite fragments from an old poem, something about no man being an island, and ending with, "Ask not for whom the bell tolls." But that's all he can remember. Like all the memories that have been coming back to him, he sees only pieces, shards. He closes his eyes and sees a group of children at a rink. A fight breaks out. Billy Moses punches Edmund. He falls to the ice. Another boy jumps in to help, pushes Billy. Tries to hit him with a hockey stick just as Edmund is getting up. But instead of hitting Billy Moses, he hits Edmund with the backswing. Now there's blood on the ice and Edmund is screaming. And Billy Moses is laughing as he skates away down the street to where he lives with his grandmother, the witch. Now the man sees a group of teenagers sitting around a wooden table. He knows this room, the cracked linoleum, the wood stove, and he recognizes the children. These are the ones nobody wanted. Edmund and Frances taken in when their mother was hit by a train. Monica when her mother drowned herself. And seated next to Monica, a young boy. He knows the boy. It's him. In another time. It's late Saturday morning, and Grandmother is upstairs resting after a morning of doing laundry and hanging it out in the January cold. Frances grabs his coat and skates and announces he's going out to play hockey, but Monica and the one-eyed Edmund stay at the table with the boy. Just as Frances is leaving, old Danny comes in. Monica tells him Grandmother is upstairs, but Danny takes no notice. He removes his coat and sits at the table.
I'll just sit for a bit and have a cup of tea while I wait.
Monica pours a brimming cup of strong tea, puts it on the table in front of him, and sits beside Danny. He looks at her and seems as if he's about to say something, but instead he lights his pipe, spills tea from cup to saucer, raises it to his lips and sips, and says,
"You wouldn't happen to have a wee slice of bread, would you?"
Monica gets up to fetch it while the boy remembers what Danny had said about the queer ones being blessed with the gift of second sight. They could see the unseen devils and witches in the world with their flat gray eyes. Now the boy looks at Edmund's fish eye and wonders what he can see with it. Edmund's dead eye peers into Danny and asks for the story of Finn's fiddle.
"I'm not sure I remember that one."
"He played it for the devil that time."
"I don't recall such a story."
"In the forest, just outside Petit Fleurette's shack. He played the fiddle so the devil would leave her alone. All night long, he played to win her soul."
"Jesus H, that's a wild one. Are you sure I'm the one who told it to you?"
But of course Danny was the one. If anyone knew the story, it was Danny. Wasn't Finn his own flesh and blood? His son? Danny looks as if he's trying to remember the story, but is distracted by Monica putting a thick slice of buttered bread in front of him. He nods and smiles.
"Oh, that's grand, but you wouldn't happen to have a little bit of molasses, would you?"
Edmund's dead eye is not to be denied a story, and he says,
"Petite Fleurette, Billy Moses' mother, the witch's daughter, the one she promised to the devil."
"The Chabuqua witch. Sold her three daughters to the devil, and each of them leaving behind infants."
Monica says,
"What happened to the babies?"
Don't worry. They're safe where they are. That's all I can say. Sworn to secrecy."
"I don't care about the babies. I want to hear about Finn's battle with the devil."
Even if I knew that story, how could I tell it to you without first telling you about the witch? Have I ever told you the time I brought a young woman to see her? What a hellish time that was.
But of course the children have heard the story, and know that the young woman in it is no longer young, but an old woman now, the same one who was lying upstairs, resting, though no one will say this aloud.
The woman's name was, well, let's call her Elizabeth. She and her husband settled here just after gold was discovered in 1912. Then the war came, and all that bloody business in the trenches. Well, it wasn't long after the end of the Great War, around the time all the young soldiers were being sent back home, that Elizabeth first saw the dead man. He appeared one day while Joseph was out cutting pulpwood, and Elizabeth was home alone. She looked out the veranda window and saw this man walking along the road in front of the house, his movements all stiff and unnatural, like he was under some kind of spell. He'd walk part way up the hill, then turn and come back, and then go up the hill again. And he was wearing a woolen army greycoat, even though it was the hottest day of summer. Elizabeth watched for a while and then went out and brought him a glass of water. He drank it, looked up the hill and went about his way. When he came back, she took him by the arm, sat him in the veranda and brought him in for a plate of food. But he just sat and looked at it as if he no longer had any need for earthly things. She tried to encourage him to eat, but the best he could do was bring the fork to his mouth, then put it back. She went to the kitchen to get him some tea, and when she returned, she saw he'd left. So she looked out the window and saw him continuing his pilgrimage up the hill and back, searching for his lost battalion. That's what he was doing. He continued the long march with his head down until nightfall, and Elizabeth knew it was only a matter of time before the death inside him put him in the ground forever. That following winter, the man, whose name was McMaster, tried to hang himself, but was cut down in the basement of the St. Louis Hotel. When Elizabeth heard this, she knew she must do something to save him. So one day, while Joseph was cutting pulpwood in the Abitibi Canyon, she got a man to bring her up Chappaqua Mountain to get a cure for death. And now we get to it, you see. I was the one she'd asked to bring her to the mountain. Well, of course, I told her that what she was doing was pure foolishness. And I told her that you can't trust a goddamned witch. And didn't I remind her how the Kupal woman had gone looking for a cure for her husband's lip cancer? And what did she end up with? Three sons who turned into wild beasts every night, drinking and fighting and howling at the moon. No better than a loup-garou.
Was her husband cured?
Forget about the Kupal man. That's not the point. Will you listen to what I'm trying to tell you about the witch? The point I'm trying to make is that no one ever gets what they're looking for from the witch. Not a cure for cancer, and certainly not a cure for the dead. All they get is witchy tricks. The devil's business. That's what I told Elizabeth, but do you think she'd listen?
What happened to her?
Oh, for the love of Christ! If you'll stop interrupting me every 2 seconds, and just give me a chance to talk, I'll tell you what happened.
The children listen to Danny's story now and can see him hitching the horse to the sleigh, and can see the young woman sitting beside him wrapped in a striped woolen blanket. The little horse gives her head a shake and heads off into the dying light. West of town, they reach the base of the mountain, and the mare snorts as she labors through the deep hillside snow. She climbs up the deep snowy path, but stops when she smells the witch's cabin and refuses to go any further. So Danny helps Elizabeth down, and from there she goes on alone, wading through the snow towards the summit.
I called to her, warned her one last time that no good would come of it, only evil. It was as if she was already under the witch's spell.
It takes an hour for Elizabeth to reach the witch's shack, but when she does, it's as if the witch has been waiting for her, has a pot of tea brewing over the fire, smiles at Elizabeth and says,
"Oh, I see you've come. What is it you want from me?"
Elizabeth approaches the flame.
"Not for me, for the man, McMaster. Something that will cure the death in him."
You women, always trying to save some man who's beyond saving.
The witch scoops a cup of tea from the pot and hands it to Elizabeth.
Do you have something?
Yes, but there's a price. Are you willing to pay what I ask?
In the soft purple light, Elizabeth nods consent, and the two women go inside the shack. Now Elizabeth sees a thin child huddled in the shadows. This is the youngest of the witch's three daughters, the one called Petite Fleurette. The witch speaks to the girl in a blunt language Elizabeth does not understand, and the girl melts into the darkness of the adjacent room. Then the Chabacois witch takes from a wooden shelf a small stoppered bottle and hands it to Elizabeth.
On the night of the first full moon of spring, give him this to drink, with three drops of your blood in it.
And your price?
The witch takes a knife and slices open her wrist. A thin red line appears, but then it widens to a ribbon and begins to drip. She hands Elizabeth the knife and says,
"Do the same."
Elizabeth slices the blade into her flesh and says,
"Is that all?"
Now the witch holds up her wrist and says,
"Press your wrist on mine."
So Elizabeth does, thinking this only witchy superstition, and the two allow their blood to commingle and drip onto the floor.
My blood is your blood, and yours is mine.
Now Elizabeth feels the effects of the tea. Nausea swirls in the pit of her stomach, and the lines of the room begin to warp, as if they know there is no such thing in the world as a straight line, and are trying to find their way back to the circle they came from. She wants to get up and leave, but her legs feel as thick as sawn logs. The scene she is in seems unreal, and she stands outside herself and watches as the witch removes her clothes. When the witch is naked, she opens the door to the wood stove, reaches straight into the fire, and pulls out a sapphire flame. It stands next to her and begins to dance with her, and then it presses her to the wall and writhes against her. Now Elizabeth struggles to her feet, wanting to leave, but her body is too heavy to move, and her legs will not obey her. She stands there as the flame abandons the witch and leaps onto her, holding her, pressing himself against her, his muscular body against hers, scalding her bare thighs and her naked belly. When he's done with her, he retreats. Now she's in her right head again and sees she is naked. She picks up her clothes, and as the witch laughs, she runs from the cabin. In the distance, the witch calls to her across the forest, telling her the deal has been sealed. Elizabeth clings to the glass vial as she staggers through the snow. When the shack is out of sight, she falls panting to her knees, then collapses naked onto the deep white snow, but it has no power to cool all the places the flame has touched. She lifts her body from the snow and dresses in the dark, puts the potion in her pocket and staggers down the long slope. When she gets partway down, she finds Danny and thanks him for waiting all night.
That's what Elizabeth believed. She thought she'd been gone for hours, when in fact it had been 2 days.
The three children gasp.
Jesus, the sight of her was enough to put the fear of the Lord in you. She was all ragged and pale, and seemed as if she'd just come back from the pit of hell itself. Even the horse knew there was something evil near and whinnied in fear. I had to help her into the sleigh and tried to put the blanket around her, but she'd have none of it and told me she was burning up. I asked her if she got the cure and she showed me the small bottle. I took it from her and smelled it, but it seemed no more than water to me. "She's tricked you," I said, and asked what she'd promised the witch for this potion. And when I got home, I ministered to her wounds. I could see nothing on her skin, but she told me she'd been scalded. So I rubbed her arms and legs with liniment, and I could tell she was suffering, drawing in her breath every time I touched her skin.
Now Danny hears Grandmother coming down the stairs. He rises to his feet and says,
"Oh, I think it's time I left."
Monica walks him to the door, and before Danny leaves, she whispers,
"Did the cure work?"
Danny shakes his head as if to say, "You can't trust a witch."
What did the witch mean when she said, My blood is your blood.
Daniel looks over at the boy sitting at the table and says,
Do us a favor, will you? And keep an eye on the lad.
The Chappaqua Witch was written by Rick DeMille, read by Rick DeMille, Walter Keeley, Leslie DeMille, Bonnie DeMille, and Wesley George, with music by Duncan Cameron. This has been a Charlie Cormorant production. Stay tuned for episode 4.